BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening.
Good morning, everyone. So my name's Molly. I'm one of the education nurses with the BDNG. And today I've got Marion Nicholson from a charity called HVA. Marion, could you introduce yourself to the listeners? What is your job and what is the charity HVA stand for?
Good morning. Yes. HVA is Herpes Viruses Association. Back in 1985, I started volunteering for the Herpes Viruses Association as a helpline volunteer. And then in due course, the then director retired and I took over, and I've been running the charity since then. And in fact, I got an MBE this summer for the work that we've been doing. Now, we answer questions that patients will send in on every medium possible. So it could be Facebook Messenger, it could be an email, it is very frequently a helpline call. And we, of course, have a website which is incredibly well regarded by people who find it. Finding it is the tricky thing, of course, because if you put herpes into a search engine, you're going to get so many different other organizations which come up first. And we cannot compete with the Mayo Clinic in America. But I'm afraid even some quite small charities manage to get themselves ahead of us in a search for herpes. So anyone out there who knows any SEO experts who'd like to come and help us get our charity higher in the ratings, I'd be delighted to hear from them. Herpes is an odd condition because people phone and they say to me, I don't mind having herpes, I just would hate to have to pass it on to anybody. I cannot think of another condition in the world where people say, I don't mind having it, I would just hate passing it on. So we often suggest to people, and indeed funders, that herpes is not really, and of course, when I say herpes, I'm using that as a shorthand term for genital herpes simplex.
So what is genital herpes simplex for the listeners who might not know very much about it, or maybe only see it once in a while in their clinic settings or in their work settings? What exactly is that?
So herpes simplex is one of a family of 9 human herpes viruses. Herpes simplex comes in 2 forms, type 1 and type 2. And by the way, herpes 3 is chickenpox. And when it recurs, we call it shingles. And some of the others are glandular fever. What all these viruses have in common is that once you're infected with them, they could recur. But this is not unusual. Thrush is a fungal infection. But once you've got that, you've got it for life. The difference with herpes simplex when it affects the genitals is society's attitude towards it. And that was what I was saying when I was talking about the fact that people say they don't mind having it, they just would hate to pass it on. Because the stigma associated with having a cold sore on your genitals is just tremendous. But of course, only in English-speaking countries, and I can explain that as well, Molly, if you want to know. But right now, herpes simplex type 1 and type 2. Back in the old days, before people did oral sex, when it was really a very restricted condition to highly sophisticated lovers, you could pretty well say that type 1 affected the face and type 2 infected the genitals. But what's happened since, perhaps the 1970s, is that oral sex has become more and more popular, so that, as you all know, probably oral sex is now regarded as perhaps even less, intimate than having ordinary penetrative sex. People will do oral sex and still consider themselves to be virgins, which means that type 1, which, as we say, used to just be something on the face, is increasingly being the cause of cold sores on the genitals. In some parts of the UK, in clinics, sexual health clinics, when they diagnose a new case of genital herpes, more than half the new cases are caused by herpes simplex type 1. Now, this has a very interesting result for the people who catch it. Type 1 is a virus that has evolved to, as it were, like the face, and it recurs more frequently when you have it on the face. So when you catch it genitally, you don't get many recurrences, which means it bothers you less. But equally, because everyone you meet has got type 1 on their face, or many of them do, I'll give you the stats in a moment, it means that they can't catch type 1 from you. So a person with type 1 genitally doesn't really need to worry about it much at all. Type 2, on the other hand, likes the genitals. And if you catch type 2 on the genitals, you're more likely to get a recurrence. With oral sex, people can catch type 2 on their faces. So if they do oral sex on a person with type 2 genitally, they could catch type 2 on their face, where it would be a cold sore. But because type 2 doesn't like the face, people really don't get recurrences when they catch type 2 on the face.
And when you're saying about these kind of things, what kind of symptoms would a person have that would maybe cause them to go to example for a GP or a practice nurse? What would they be noticing? That is it painful? Is it sore? Is it bleeding? What happens to the person when they catch this, or when they begin to have symptoms? What exactly happens?
The fascinating thing, Molly, is that 2 out of 3 people, when they catch it, have it so mildly, whether this is type 1 or type 2, and no matter where they catch it, they will have it so mildly they will not notice. So when we say, what will a person have when they catch herpes to go and see a doctor, a nurse, or a sexual health clinic if it's genital, the answer is they will be unlucky and they'll have a really bad case. And for a bad case, well, it usually starts with feeling unwell, general sort of flu-like symptoms. And then after a day or two, the place where you have caught it will start feeling itchy or sore or painful. The nerve sensations could be any of those different things. And then you will get actual blisters on the site. And of course, we've all seen pictures, if not people, with cold sores. And therefore, it's quite common for people to get those kind of blisters. If the sore is on the inner vulva area, the skin can't actually blow up and form a blister. It's too delicate. And therefore, for a lady, or indeed under a foreskin, the blister actually is just a lump that then turns into a lesion or an ulcer.
And then, is there kind of a more common person that might get this? Like, is it tend to be young people, or could it happen to any age range?
It happens to everybody at some point in their life. Well, almost everybody. So statistics from the UK show that by age 15, a quarter of children have already caught type 1. Of course, most of that will be on the face. But I mean, with oral sex and with fingering, because of course you can get a cold sore on your fingers. Back in the old days, before dentists wore plastic gloves, all dentists had whitlows on their fingers, in other words, cold sores on their fingers. And of course, all dentists with cold sores on their fingers would pass it on to their next client. Now, of course, that doesn't happen. But so we've got 15-year-olds, a quarter of them. By 25, 7 out of 10 people have caught type 1 or type 2. And then by the age of 35, statistics from Australia show that 85% of women, 8.5 out of 10, and more than 3/4 of men have got type 1, and about 1 in 5 has got type 2. So for the women, that adds up to 107%, because some have got both. But put it the other way, fewer than 15% of women age 35 do not have type 1 or type 2. Again, research from London has found that on average, if a person has had 7 sexual partners in their life, then it is more likely than not that they have herpes simplex type 2. But most of them won't know, as I say. So those few people who get it badly enough to notice carry this burden of having herpes, the stigma that is attached to that. And 2 out of 3 are running around totally ignorant of the fact and getting on with their lives. Differential diagnosis for those of you who are seeing people with problems on their skin. We have put, I gave a lecture at the British Association of Dermatology annual conference 2 years ago on differential diagnosis, and it was very popular. And as a result, I have put our slide of 28 different things that a professional will need to consider when the patient thinks.
Is it possible that, for example, a patient might have Googled something and think that it might be something else and would maybe come and say, oh, I think it's this thing. Is that also possible as well?
Not really. Patients haven't heard of Behçet's syndrome or ORF virus. And very few of them have heard of Mpox. It's usual whenever they have anything wrong with the genitals that they Google herpes, and it's usually the other way around.
So somebody
who's had three swabs of their sores and they're all negative, but the patient is still convinced they have herpes. Well, that's where the professional needs to steer them, well, to do some more work to find out what it is. And the differential diagnosis slide is on our professional page of our website, ladies and gentlemen. So herpes.org.uk, and then on the resources page, the professional page. No, it's got its own tab, professional. You'll find it right at the top there, a link to the differential diagnosis.
A swab that people would take to ascertain whether or not they have herpes? You were talking about patients that would have had swabs and maybe would have been negative. Is that the usual way that you would diagnose it, or would people have to have biopsies, for example? How do people generally, is it a visual thing? How does the diagnosis generally happen?
Obviously, sexual health clinics are so experienced at looking at the sores that they can tell, for instance, the difference in appearance between a herpes simplex sore and a syphilis sore at a glance. I've seen pictures of both of those, and to me, those photos look pretty much identical. So yes, a swab from the lesion is the only diagnostic tool. Patients will buy for themselves online blood tests for the herpes simplex antibody. Do not use, in fact, in America, the government health body has issued an open letter to all doctors saying, do not use those blood tests. They are too unreliable. 1 in 10 positives is wrong. 3 in 10 negatives is wrong. So patients are misdiagnosing themselves or not diagnosing themselves because they get they pay for the blood test. So a swab is the only way. And sexual health clinics are usually the place that do the swabs. Some GPs are set up to do these swabs, but you have to have the right kit, obviously, to do the swab. And that's the only reliable test. Now, a degree of suspicion could come into this. Because, you know, I said earlier that only 1 in 3 will get diagnosed. The other 2 out of 3 may have minor symptoms, Molly. So, for instance, we've heard people have spoken to us and told us of, for instance, an infected hair follicle, which comes up every 6 months or so. And then after a while, they get that hair follicle swabbed and they discover that actually it was a herpes simplex sore all along. And then a man phoned up and said, she must have caught it from me because she was a virgin when we started having sex. But I don't have anything. But because, you see, he was really interested and concerned, we talked long enough. Oh, yes, he said, I get a little cut on the side of my penis from time to time. So his little cut was actually all he had in the way of herpes simplex outbreak. And now that he knows that this little cut is infectious, of course, he's now a safer partner. But you can see equally that unless the woman had been a virgin, he would have gone, oh, I'm sure you caught it before you met me. I don't have anything. And he would have carried on. Now, another diagnostic tool you can use in the clinic is this. A first infection will cover usually both sides of a person's anatomy, left side and right side. But recurrences of herpes simplex are unilateral. Just like number 3, which is shingles, that is unilateral. So when somebody comes to you with sore, itching, something which is happening on both sides of their anatomy, probably not herpes simplex, one side of the anatomy, well worth looking into it. When you think of it, thrush, or indeed eczema on the vulva, they will be equally on both sides of the anatomy. But herpes simplex, which could mimic the symptoms of thrush or eczema, will be one side only. That's a very useful clinical tool.
And then, for example, let's say a patient came, they had the examination of the area that they were worried about, maybe a swab was taken. What happens after that person gets the results? Is there treatments that the person has to have, for example, tablets or medications, or is it simply conservative measures, or does it depend on the kind of symptoms that that person has? What kind of happens after the diagnosis part?
Luckily, treatment is always optional. I say luckily because, of course, as I keep saying, most people don't even know they have it. So a person who's got it badly can have pills. The antiviral pills are very safe. They've been used for a long time. And people can take them. While they're taking them, they work. When they don't take them, they don't work. So it's not as though it's any sort of curative plan. It is just a suppressive plan. When I'm explaining this to patients, I say, look, it works as a contraceptive pill for virus. When you're taking it, the virus can't do its thing. When you stop taking it, it is as though you had never taken it. It has no long-term effect.
Mm-hmm. So you mean like a prophylactic, maybe?
Exactly.
Okay.
It can be taken daily for people who are, well, there are two classes of people who will choose to have it daily. Those are people who find that they are getting a lot of recurrences. There are some unlucky ladies who find that in rhythm with their period, they get an outbreak every month, and they might choose to take the pills on a daily basis. The other ones are the people who are so psychologically screwed up by the stigma of the word herpes that they really could not enjoy a normal adult sex life without the reassurance that they are taking the pills. Of course, there's one other category of people who will be taking those pills on a daily basis, and those are people who have got immunocompromised, perhaps they are taking drugs to lower their immune system due to, for instance, having had a transplant or having the conditions that need that kind of immunosuppressive treatment. And they will have herpes simplex, antiviral therapy given to them on a daily basis with their other cocktail of drugs, because otherwise they could indeed get repeated cold sores or indeed repeated chickenpox outbreaks, shingles. So that would be normal for them. The other way of using those pills, actually, rather than taking them daily, Molly, people can just use them episodically. Now, that means that they have the pills handy in their pocket, handbag, briefcase. And the moment they feel the beginning of a recurrence, whether it's in every month or whether it's every 2 years or whether it's every 10 years, they can start taking the drug, and if they take the drug at the first warning signs, they can actually stop the virus dead in its tracks at that point, and they don't get the outbreak.
Mm-hmm. And you were saying warning signs. So, for example, if I was prescribing this medication or maybe talking to the patient about what to do, would that just be what they would normally have symptom-wise? So, for example, you were talking about that young lady with kind of infected hair, what she described as an infected hair follicle, or the gentleman with the tear on his lower genitals, would I just be saying to them, okay, when you start noticing the first signs of those symptoms, that's when to start taking the tablets? Is that normally kind of what we would generally suggest, is kind of the patient might know their own symptoms the best and to work it out depending on that? Or is there specific warning signs that I would say, okay, this is what you're looking for to start this medication?
The patient will need to learn what their own warning signs are. Luckily for most of us, the warning signs start with nerve sensations. You see, the herpes viruses 1, 2 and 3, chickenpox, live in a neural ganglion beside the spine. When they reactivate, they ride the tide of nutrient fluids, I love that expression, down to the skin to reinfect the skin cell and make new blisters. They're safe inside the nerve sheaths. Neither the antiviral, acyclovir, nor the immune system can get at them in there. But as they ride this tide of nutrient fluids, they can irritate the nerve. And therefore, the person will notice a nerve sensation at the place where the cold sore, or indeed the shingles outbreak, is going to happen. And that can be an itching, a tingling, a stabbing, a burning, an aching, a pressure buildup under the skin, like those volcanoes that you used to feel on your chin when you were getting teenage spots. But the person will need to learn what their own warning signs feel like. And of course, they can actually change from one outbreak to the next. Although I suppose there is usually a pattern. But it's going to be in just one small area where the spot is going to erupt. And using the pills, or indeed a herbal cream with lemon balm mint, I can talk to you about that if you're interested in alternative therapies. At the moment you feel those warning signs, can actually mean that the virus cannot make the leap safely from the nerve sheath into the skin cell, and therefore you actually abort the outbreak, which is very satisfactory for the patient and their sex life.
Mm-hmm. And I think you were talking a little bit about the kind of psychological impact on people. And as dermatology nurses, sometimes we do discuss with people the impact that their skin can have, for example, on relationships. Is there kind of something that in particular that people with herpes, is it mainly the stigma? Is it, for example, that the spots or boils can leak into clothing? Is there a particular thing that causes that psychological impact?
It's rare that the outbreak is going to be physically a problem. The virus is transmitted by direct skin-to-skin contact with the affected part. So people do not need to worry about transmitting it on clothing, towels, toilet seats, or anything else that they can invent. When the virus is active, so between recurrences, they don't need to worry. We have a section on the asymptomatic shedding business on our website, but quite frankly, it is a low risk, and therefore it is hugely exaggerated by the drug makers in order to get people to take drugs more than they might otherwise have chosen to do. Skin-to-skin contact with the affected part when the virus is active with friction. It's got to be massaged in because the virus cannot move by itself. So they don't need to worry about clothing. But the psychology, because of the creation of the stigma about 40 years ago, is incredibly important. And this is where nurses' role is so very helpful, because nurses talk to patients, as you say. They're not just diagnosers and pill hand routers. One of the things I say to people, medics, when I'm giving my talk is, talk about it with the patient with the same level of concern and warning, and I put that in heavy quotes and underlined in italics, sarcastically, as you would cold sores. No one tells a person with a cold sore, oh, you've got to tell every future partner, you know, before you kiss them, that you have a cold sore on your face. No one says, oh my God, look at your face, you've got a cold sore and you went down on me 3 weeks ago. There is no need for the level of scaremongering which goes on with a diagnosis of genital herpes. To frighten a person who has a genital cold sore more than you would a person who has a facial cold sore is purely the stigma due to sexual activity which permeates society, I'm afraid. It's particularly silly that there are so many websites that try to frighten people about with genital herpes. When I repeat that 2 out of 3 people have it and do not know, it's a little bit like fitting a speedometer to only 1 car in 3 and threatening the 1 car that has a speedo with terrible fines if they go over the speed limit, while letting the other 2 cars that just happen not to have a speedo do what they like. So think of it as a cold sore. The warnings necessary are only the same level of warnings that you would give a person with a cold sore, which is don't kiss somebody when you have a cold sore or if you feel one coming on. And you wouldn't frighten them any more than that. And use words that you would for cold sores. No one tells people with a cold sore you have a chronic, incurable condition. I mentioned earlier that thrash is something that is chronic and incurable, but no one says to ladies that they have incurable and chronic thrush. Both incurable and chronic, of course, Molly, in the public's mind, have got connotations of severity. Chronic, my goodness, that's bad. And incurable, well, you're going to die, aren't you, if you have an incurable disease? And of course, we know that for medical personnel, they have totally different ideas. So,
there's like being mindful of the language and the consultation that we're using, and being mindful of what that person might take when they leave the room or when they go home and they're digesting that information later on. So, being, I think, you know, it's a good way that you're saying talk about it in the same way that you might talk about a cold sore,
exactly,
to not frighten that person, because I think probably a lot of these people, especially if they do have symptoms, are probably reasonably quite worried and quite anxious about it, I would assume.
We advise people to go to our website and indeed phone our helpline so that they can get good information. Even the NHS website, I keep telling them, write about herpes simplex in the same way that you have written about chickenpox or about cold sores. And indeed, I regularly get NHS choices to change the way they word their pages on herpes simplex. It's very difficult for the health advisor, for the nurse, to know precisely how to talk to the patient, because the patient will have different levels of anxiety or misery according to what they already think, whether they've Googled it or whether they sort of vaguely know that mummy gets cold sores and therefore this is just a cold sore. So you really do have to do a detective work before you even know how to talk to the patient. But I have a really good line that I use on the helpline. When I can hear that the patient, the person on the call, the caller, wants to hang up, you know, they're sort of rounding off the call. And I just sort of add, look, if ever you hear anything which is scary, or you read something that's worrying, do you know it's probably wrong? Get back in touch with me because we can give you the correct information about that.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking about good information and that the information that you guys kind of put forward. How do people signpost to that? You were talking about a helpline. Do people go on your website for that? Do they... is there leaflets that nurses, particularly who might be working more in a kind of genital wart clinic or a sexual health center or something like that, is there a way that we can maybe signpost to that?
Absolutely. On the resources page, Molly, we've got leaflets. There's a very complete booklet which people can buy, but we can send out the ordinary, you know, bifold leaflet, the DL-shaped leaflet. We can send out little cards. They're just, you know, credit card sized little cards that nurses can hand out to patients with our contact details on them. Our website, herpes.org.uk, has got a contact us page with either the helpline number, the office number, or you know, where they can type in their questions, and we answer those on a daily basis. All the information we provide, ladies and gentlemen, is based on the BASH guideline, British Association for Sexual Health and HIV. The expert doctors special interest group has just rewritten their guideline. I was on the writing panel. And so that makes sure that the information is up to date and accurate. And, you know, we're not going out on a limb with any of our suggestions.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking about some of the things that you guys do, like your helpline and all the different resources, like the leaflets and the booklets and things like that. Is there also research that you guys do into, for example, you were talking about the stigma that people face, or it might be treatments, or it might be ways to, for example, prevent or reduce the risk of people catching this? Is there kind of extra, I guess, researcher, things like that, that you guys also do?
We don't have money. So the research we do is always research that can't be, that doesn't require a lot of money. Professionals are doing research on vaccines, on different drugs, because the current drug could be improved. Cyclovir has to be taken twice a day. So a pill is in the in trial form, which you take once a week. Now you can see that that's hugely more convenient for the patient. There are two different vaccine trials going on at the moment. In America, there are a couple of trials which are fascinating. They are going to send a molecular scissor up the nerve to chop the virus up in the neural ganglion, kill off the virus in the neural ganglion. That will effectively be a cure because it will remove the virus from the patient's body. It works 97% fully in poor little furry animals. And they haven't started trials in humans yet. They have to be really careful before they send molecular scissors into a neural ganglion. If things went awry, the human being could end up paraplegic. We are doing research, however, with a team in Gloucestershire because, you know, I mentioned the nerve sensations that often precede the outbreak.
Yeah.
Well, some people report that these nerve sensations go on for months after their first infection. They phone me up and they tell me it's been 6 weeks now, it's been 4 weeks, it's been, you know. I want to know how long these nerve sensations go on for. I want to know in what proportion of people they happen. I can't do that research because only people self-refer to us. So it's only the people with the problem who phone me. But the clinic in Gloucestershire is going to sign up their new patients and follow them for a year to see how many of them get this kind of problem. So that will be very exciting. You mentioned stigma, Molly. Well, I wrote a paper that was published in STI, along with Dr. O'Farrell, on our members' view of stigma, self-selected group, and it shows indeed how much more this virus is a problem that affects them psychologically rather than a problem that affects them physically.
Right.
And in the spring, we did a YouGov survey, which was also very interesting. And I'm writing a paper for STI right now on that.
And in the people, I know you were saying it could affect all age ranges. In the people who feel the stigma, is it tend to be older people, younger people, or is it just generally across the board that people do kind of feel this stigma or this kind of, for example, that the language that is used, they feel very isolated or very embarrassed about what they have?
Remember, people have to learn that it is a stigmatized condition. If a doctor were to tell you you had winifritis, I've just invented the word, so don't look it up, you wouldn't immediately go, oh my God, that's terrible. You would say, winifritis? I've never heard of that, doctor, or Google, tell me what winifritis is. And then you might learn that it's a highly stigmatized condition, or you might learn that it's an utterly unimportant condition that all babies have by the age of two. And it's the same with herpes. Now, herpes, of course, does get a bit of stigma that precedes people doing any Googling. But of course, when you do Google it, by definition, you're going to get the more scary, the more dramatic sites on any of the patient forums. It's only the worried patients who are there. And you asked about age group, Molly. Young people say, well, it would be all right if I was older. It wouldn't matter so much. They don't worry about things. But my group, oh, my goodness. And then the old people go, well, you know, those young people, they don't worry about it. But, oh, you know, it's so embarrassing at my age to have it.
So it basically both groups feel relatively the same. So I guess what I'm just trying to say is that sometimes, for example, in clinic, you might assume, oh, because it's a younger person, therefore there's going to be a bigger impact on their mental health. Whereas in fact, it could be any person of any age range who is presenting with these symptoms that could potentially have feel that there is a psychological impact, and that it's important for us to ask and open up about these questions to them and ask how they're managing in their day-to-day life. So
beware, you don't ask somebody with a cold how are you managing in your day-to-day life and how is it affecting you. So again, even the way you ask that question can lead to the idea that whether or not it's something more important or more, you know, more something you need to worry about. So I would just say something like, do you have questions about this condition? Is there anything that's worrying you about the condition? But say it in a very neutral way, not in a sort of, oh, is there anything worrying you? Are you worried about it? You know, because you don't want to imply that it's a serious life-altering condition. Mm-hmm. Because that in itself, my goodness, the doctor was so worried about my mental health. It must be really serious. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a really tricky one. And ladies and gentlemen, when you're talking to somebody with genital herpes, you really do have to put on your best possible listening antennae to pick up where they're at, to take it from there and lessen their load without saying anything that is going to make them worry more. But it's very tricky, and it's something our helpliners have to deal with on a daily basis.
Definitely. Well, thank you very much for all that information. Can you just say one more time where people can access this information? You were saying on your website, could you just tell us again what that website is?
So it's the Herpes Viruses Association. Viruses in the plural, because as you've heard, there are nine. And the website is herpes.org.uk. And there you will find a professionals page. You will also find a resources page and also a contact us page. And I'll be very happy to send you more information about our resources. I regularly give Zoom chats to groups of people and can therefore, with slides, so happy to come and talk to any of your groups about herpes simplex, or indeed about all the herpes viruses. We can cover shingles and glandular fever as well.
Thank you very much, Marion. This has been really interesting. It's really interesting to learn more about this condition and the different things, like you were saying, about the research in Gloucestershire, about the stigma that people can face, as well as all the resources that seem really helpful, not only for professionals, but also for the patients who might want to access those resources. So thank you so much for joining me. And thanks, everyone, for listening in. Hope you all have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website, bdng.org.uk, and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.